If you like dropping bombs from downtown, you've come to the right place.
Ahead to Curry. Curry sets, fires, puts it up. Bang! Steph Curry from way downtown.
Get ready for all things basketball.
Let it rain!
Where the hot takes get even hotter.
He's on fire!
This is Beyond the Arc with Jacob Reimer.
All right, everyone, welcome back for another episode of Beyond the Arc. I am your host, Jacob Reimer, and the NBA Finals are set. Warriors versus Celtics, going at it for the NBA Championship, NBA Finals, and the 75th season. This matchup goes way back, all the way to the 60s, battle between Wilt and Bill Russell, all the way back then. But we did a little recap of the Warriors and Mavs series, Western Conference Finals, on the last pod, before we had Game 6 and Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals. It ended up going to 7 games, and the Celtics prevailed. They were just dominant in Game 7 against the Heat. They held off a late run by Miami, more like they almost gave it away. Marcus Smart almost gave it away. But Celtics move on. Jason Tatum, Eastern Conference Finals MVP, and Celtics are going on to the championship for the first time since 2010. Been 12 years. Crazy to think that how historic a franchise like Boston is to not have made an NBA Finals appearance since 2012. It's kind of crazy. But big matchup here with the Warriors. We're going to do a little recap here of the Eastern Conference Finals. This series was it was really boring until the very end. Game 6 and Game 7. Game 7 was kind of boring as well, but they got good late. Like, there was clutch shots being made, and like Max Strus's three that like cut it to 5 or something like that, when it looked like, to me, I thought he was going to hand it off to Victor Oladipo. He ended up just pulling up from deep, and it was real quick money. I was like, oh my gosh, okay then, Strus. There were some controversial calls there in that Game 7. Like, a three got taken away from Max Strus. The foot was on the set. They reviewed it for a 2 or a 3, but then they ended up calling out of bounds. Like, his foot was on the line. His foot was hovering. I don't know. It looked like it was hovering over it, but it wasn't exactly on it. So I think the Heat maybe got screwed there. But the big thing that everybody's coming at the Heat for in this series is how Game 7 ended. They're down 2. With shot clock off, they get a stop, they come down, Jimmy Butler, he's got Al Horford, basically a one-on-one with Al Horford, Strus spotting up in the corner, PJ Tucker and Victor Oladipo running the wings on the other side, and Jimmy Butler pulls up from 3 on Al Horford, going for the win instead of attacking him off the dribble, potentially maybe stopping on a dime look for a little pull-up. We're just taking him all the way to the rim because he has the quickness on Al Horford. He has the finishing ability on Al Horford. Like, he can finish against Al Horford. But instead, Jimmy decided to pull up for 3. And everyone's like, why, Jimmy? Why? Why taking that shot? That's not your game. That's just go for the tie. Go to overtime. Jimmy Butler played so fantastic. Like, in Game 6, he literally pulled off a LeBron 2012 Game 6 performance. He had more points than LeBron did in that 2012. He ended up with 47. Made ridiculous shots late. Clutch plays down the stretch, holding off the Celtics and forcing in Game 7. This man just battles. He's just a gutsy player. And I love Jimmy Butler for it, because you don't see many players like that anymore, the way they fight. I mean, Jimmy Butler played every single minute in Game 7. I completely understand the shot. He was gassed. If it goes to overtime, who knows if he can move? Who knows if he can do anything in the overtime? He ended up taking the 3, was just short. He's going to be practicing this shot all offseason long to try and get back to this point. The Heat, they weren't healthy. Tyler Hero, he wasn't healthy. Kyle Lowry was banged up in the series. Jimmy Butler was banged up in the series. So they were battling some injury a lot. If this Heat team can come back next year at full strength, they're going to be tough to beat. But the Celtics, they're insane with their defense. They're insane. Going to the finals, and what's crazy about that is on January 22nd, just what, 4 months ago, little over 4 months ago, they were one game below 500, 23-24, and now they are going to their 22nd NBA Finals, and Jason Tatum has been unstoppable. He's just been a monster, just insane, just been insane on the basketball floor. Like, this man just cannot be stopped, really. He's a great, great two-way player, can defend. He, like, you saw him against, Okay, for later on in the show, we're kind of on Drew, we're on big Drew Timmy watch right now. We're going to talk about college basketball here in a little bit. I got Jeff Goodman tweets, John Rothstein tweets turned on. We're on Drew Timmy watch. I forgot to mention that at the beginning of the show, because tonight was the deadline for the, if you can come back to school or stay in the NBA draft. And Drew Timmy has decided to return to school, come back to Gonzaga for next year. Wow, that changes everything. Drew Timmy coming back to Gonzaga. We're going to get into that in a little bit. But that's huge news. I had tweets turned on, and I had to break that news right there. So Boston Celtics, 23-24. Insane turnaround now, going to the finals, getting the two seed, playing their full starters on the final game of the season, securing that two seed, playing the Celtics, or playing the Nets, sweeping the Nets, beating Milwaukee in seven, which you can argue that if Milwaukee has Chris Middleton, they're not losing game six in Milwaukee, or they're not losing game seven, but that don't matter. He wasn't on the floor. The Celtics are going on to the Eastern Conference Finals. They beat the Heat and are now going to the finals to take on the Golden State Warriors. This has just been an insane run. Jason Tatum is the youngest player in NBA history with 400 points, 100 rebounds, 100 assists, 50 threes made in a single playoffs. And we're not even to the finals. The finals hasn't even started. He's already put up over 400 points. Oh, that's insane. That's insane. Another crazy stat here. The Celtics have lost back-to-back games only once since January. That's when they went on their run here. Keep that in mind. In that game, they rested four starters in that loss. The turnaround for the Boston Celtics has been insane. One game below 500 just a little over 4 months ago. Below 500. I can't remember what I just said there. And they somehow, some way, get the two seed and are now going to the NBA Finals. And it's been because of their coaching. They have completely switched up. Like, there was beef between Marcus Smart, Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown because of Marcus Smart saying that Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, they don't pass the ball. They don't share the ball. It's just get the ball and get out the way. That's their show. They had a coming together. The coaching has been phenomenal. The defense has been insane, especially against Kevin Durant, Giannis Antetokounmpo, and Jimmy Butler, three of the biggest names in the NBA. And they put together an all-around and tremendous defensive performance to stop them and are now going to the NBA Finals. This story for Boston has been insane. It would be fitting for them, for how storied of a franchise it is, to go on and win the NBA championship in the 75th season, but they're coming up against a tough, really tough Golden State Warriors team. So we're going to talk about the finals here later on. Well, we're going to get into it now, but like the actual series part preview at the end of the show. So, should the NBA bring back the NBA Finals trophy logo at half court? Y'all remember that when, like in the 2010s, when like they would put the logos, they put the NBA Finals logos in the corners of around near half court, and then they would put the big trophy underneath of the team's logo at half court. I think they 100% should bring that back. What is it? What's it doing? Is it really that much of a distraction or something like that? I think it gives a completely different feel to the series, to the game that's being played. Like, I remember growing up when it first hit me that it was there. Like, when I first came to the realization that I was alive and, like, moving and loving sports and being the person that I am was probably 2008. And was it 2008? No, 2009, when it was the Lakers and Magic, and seeing that half-court logo. I mean, yeah, I know of it being 2007 with Cleveland, 08 Lakers and Celtics, 06 Heat and Dallas. Like, I remember that, but I remember it more vividly in 2008 with the Magic and Lakers, or 2009. And I remember just sitting there preparing myself for the finals, and before each game leading up to it, like, this, it just feels different. It gives a completely different feeling to the series. Like, it's the NBA Finals. This is it. You have made it. You get the right to have that trophy on your floor. Like, you've earned this spot. You deserve it. Like, national television, everything. I think it'd be great. I feel like it would be great. It gives the younger generation, like when I was growing up, it gives them that imagination. Be like, oh my gosh, I'm playing in the NBA final. Like picturing it, going out to your basketball court, if you have one, and just imaginary basketball. You're out there with the finals logo, imagining the finals logo on the court for the team that you dream of playing for. Like, if that's one of your biggest dreams, is making the NBA. That is satisfying yourself that you have made it. You have earned that stature of getting to the NBA Finals and having a chance at winning a championship, bringing home a championship to your city, and improving on your legacy. I think that would be awesome if they brought that back 100%. It would, like I've just been saying, it gives a completely different feeling to the NBA Finals. Brings so much more tension, nerves, excitement around the series. Potentially can bring get the viewers back up, get the viewing. Another NBA Finals discussion here. So ESPN posted today, imagine these certain lineups happening. Of course, like we don't imagine these matchups in the past happening, but we did not get them. The number one that everyone would have loved to have seen, that the ratings would have been off the charts for, is 100% LeBron and Kobe. If we were a few games away from that happening in 2009, Magic ultimately end up, we had it a few times when LeBron made it to the finals in 2007, when Kobe made it those 3 years in 08, 09, and 2010. We were really close from getting a LeBron and Kobe finals. That probably would have been one of the most watched NBA finals ever. And we unfortunately did not get that. There was also a picture of MJ and Hakeem. We never got to see that matchup because when Jordan retired, the first time the Magic went and won, or not the Magic, the Rockets with Hakeem Olajuwon went on and won the next two. So we never got to see that matchup, and Olajuwon never got back to the finals after that. There was also D-Wade and Steve Nash. That would have been a really fun matchup, a battle of the guards. Kevin Garnett and Tim Duncan. You can even maybe throw in Dirk Nowitzki there in that conversation of matchups that we didn't get to see. That would have been really fun. I have two that I think it'd been really cool to see. D Wade versus Kobe, because we never got to see that either. D Wade versus Kobe in the NBA Finals. That would have been an absolute treat. Kind of like Allen Iverson and Kobe 2.0. That would have been an absolute battle. It would have been fun to watch for sure. But my biggest one is in the 90s, young Shaq versus Charles Barkley versus Chuck. The two faces of NBA on TNT inside the NBA, and always cracking jokes with each other, just all the funny reels and stuff that you see through Twitter. It's mainly of those two going at it, bickering with each other and having fun with each other, joking around with each other. Can you imagine if we would have gotten an NBA Finals of those two, and then they're on now doing inside the NBA? They like one of them could just ultimately one-up the other, like, oh yeah, I busted you in the NBA Finals, so you can shut your mouth with that gold take. I mean, we were really close to that matchup potentially happening. You had in 93, right? In 93, before Jordan retired, you had the Bulls versus the Suns, and Charles Barkley was MVP that season. And then once Jordan retired, the Rockets came out of the West twice. Well, in 94, the Magic, where Shaq was with Penny Hardaway and all of them, went on to the NBA Finals the year after Charles Barkley went to the NBA Finals. But, like, that's how close we were of getting that. And it gets even closer here. Because after the Rockets won in 95, going back-to-back, Charles Barkley joined the Rockets in 96. Shaq is still in the East. We could have seen it. We could have gotten it. We were really close to getting that matchup of Charles Barkley and Shaquille O'Neal. It wouldn't have been like they're guarding each other type matchup. I mean, Chuck is only 6'6", Shaq is 7'1". Like, it wouldn't have been, like, Shaq would have dominated on the inside, but Charles Barkley, he could have held his own. He wouldn't have, like, Shaq would have backed him down a little bit, but Charles Barkley was a different breed. Like, he won MVP in the league for a reason. He got to the finals for a reason. I mean, yeah, Shaq still one-ups him all the time because Shaq's got way more rings. I mean, Charles Barkley didn't even have one. He's got an MVP, he's got great stats. Like, his year with Phoenix was unreal. Like, it was insane for Charles Barkley. And if we could have gotten that matchup of the NBA Finals, that for what has transitioned to now inside the NBA and seeing those two together, that would have been a fun matchup to see for an NBA championship, I think. All right, so now we're going to dive here a little bit into college basketball. I'm going to give you my updated, way too early top 25. So I know back on April 25th, I gave you my first one. My first unveiling, and we are now in June. I'm recording this on June 1st. I'm going to post it and air it June 2nd. So what better way to start off the month of June with an updated rankings here? And like I just said, like, my ratings are going to be changing at this moment as we speak because of Drew Timmy coming back to Gonzaga. So I'm going to give you my in consideration before I go into the top 25 list. I got UConn. I'm going to go like bottom to top. UConn, Florida State, Texas A&M, Texas Tech, and Xavier. I think all five of those teams are worthy of being inside the top 25 100%. But I'm not huge on Texas Tech this year. The defense is going to be insane. Mark Adams is going to get them to buy in. That's just who he is. That's just the coach he is. And he's going to somehow get them to do it. They don't have the same roster and the same caliber as they do last year. So that's why I have them on the outside. Xavier is going to have a great year this year. Texas A&M, they're getting some big transfers and some big guys coming back next year. Some guys returning. they're going to be right there in the mix and be flirting with being in the top 25 if they're not in the top 25 all season long. So there's the teams that I have in consideration of being in it. So now we're going to dive into the top 25. And I just want to throw this out here. The front court battle now in college basketball, it's nearly as insane as it was last year. Like last year was, I feel like this year is even like so much better with the amount of bigs coming back and the kind of players that they are and the dominance of the players that they are. I mean, yeah, last year you had Kofi Coburn in this group, but you have the player of the year and Oscar Tshiebwe coming back. You had the preseason last year pick and Drew Timmy coming back. Armando Bacot, like three guys that easily could win player of the year right there, coming back. Hunter Dickinson's also coming back, and so is Trace Jackson Davis. So the amount of front court bigs in college basketball next year, I think, is better than last year's. Like it's going to be an absolute battle on the inside each and every night between these teams if they somehow match up and pair up games. So I mean, we already got Gonzaga Baylor, which is going to be a top 10, potentially a top 5 matchup next year, because both teams are returning a lot, and it's in South Dakota. December 2nd in South Dakota, Gonzaga and Baylor, Mark Few and Scott Drew going at it again, rematch of the 2021 national championship. And I think Baylor has better guards this year than Gonzaga does. They're more experienced than what Gonzaga's guards are. Nolan Hickman and Hunter Salas aren't what like a Jalen Suggs or Andrew Nimhard are. So they're going to have some big shoes to fill, and they're going to have to step up in those big moments. And I love these early tests like Gonzaga Baylor at a neutral site. It's going to be fun. It's college basketball, man. It's June, and I like John Rothstein, we sleep in May. I have not slept. So we're going to get started here with my top 25. At number 25, I have Wyoming, and they're up three spots, coming in from not ranked. I had them at like 28 to now being inside the top 25, and that is all because of the return of Hunter Maldonado, probably the preseason Mountain West Player of the Year this year. That guy is going to be a stud for Wyoming. What the Mountain West, baby. They're back. Dayton, I have them at 24. They're even from my last rankings. Illinois, I did not have them in my in consideration last time, but I have them in. They lost Curbelo, Trent Frazier, and Kofi. But I think they're going to be so much better this year. Curbelo was a guy that just turned the ball over a ton. They just had so many guys that, like the guards, they just wanted to create for themselves, not create for others. They were either looking into Kofi for a back down two or just doing something for themselves, not looking to get others' shots. It was mainly Curbelo, and Curbelo turned the ball over a lot. They're gone now. So, and this is Illinois is a great basketball program. I think they're going to have another great season this year because of who they brought in. They're getting back Jacob Granderson. They're now getting Sky Clark, who's a highly rated point guard, a guy that's quick, can create for himself and others. That's what Illinois has not had in the past few years. And they brought in some really key transfers from the Big 12, which is the toughest conference in college basketball. And what I mean by toughest is like the most difficult to play in, because it's a gauntlet to go through. The Big Ten is probably deeper because there's more teams, but the Big 12 is just a different breed, a different beast in its own category. Those two transfers were two of the best players in the conference too. They brought in Terrence Shannon Jr. and they brought in Matthew Meyer. Matthew Meyer, really athletic. A more athletic Brady Manick, honestly. And I'm very depressed by it, because I thought and all my hopes were around him coming to Carolina and filling that Brady Manick role, but I'm not too upset, because North Carolina is still going to be North Carolina next year. They're bringing back almost everybody. He would have been a great addition to this year's team, but he ultimately has to come to Illinois, and I have to deal with him for potentially 2 to 3 times a year next year. So that's going to be fun, but it gets Illinois better, and I don't have a problem with Illinois. It's thundering right now. I don't know if you heard that, but I like Illinois in there at 23. They got a lot of people, a lot of good people coming in to make this a good season for Illinois, a much better season than what the past couple seasons have been. At 22, I have San Diego State. I had them at 22 in the last rankings as well. Arizona, or Mountain West team right there again. 21, I have Arizona down 6 spots from my last rankings, losing Benedict Mathurin, Christian Coloco, now Terry, the really athletic wing, to the NBA draft. And it's tough to see. It's tough to tell what they're going to get this year in return. Like, with, I mean, Scott Lloyd's a great coach, or Floyd, like, they're still going to compete for the Pac-12 because the Pac-12 isn't that difficult. But I have them at 21 because of the talent they're losing. They don't have any pros. I think they're going to be down there towards the bottom of the top 25 and maybe flirt with maybe getting inside the top 15, depending on the strength of wins they get and the convincing wins they get, like blowing out the teams that they should. But I don't see them getting higher than 15, honestly. At 20, I got Ohio State. They were in 20 in my rankings last time. I love the Buckeyes this year. I think they're going to be much better if they go with a more spread out offense because of the type of guards that they have and the wings that they have, the wing scoring. They're going to have guys that stretch the floor, and 1 through 4 can create for themselves and others. That opens up the floor for Zed Key on the inside, and that opens up many jump shots with jump shooters around the floor. So I think Ohio State can be 20, but the ceiling is really high for the Buckeyes next year, I think. 19 is, I have Purdue. They are down 2 spots in my rankings. I'm not high on Purdue next year. The guard play for them is going to drop significantly. It's going to be all on the inside, and you'd never know how much Zach Edey is going to be able to do for how big he is. How much he can run up and down the floor is kind of limited. So unless he puts in the work this offseason to improve his conditioning, then Purdue can be a legit contender in the Big Ten. But as of right now, I don't think that they are. At 18, I have Virginia going up 1 spot. They're returning almost 80, I think over 80% of minutes played out of everybody in college basketball last year. And they returned the most average percentage of minutes. I know that. And they got Kihei Clark coming back, and it feels like he's been there forever. They got some key transfers in. It's just going to be, do they have the wing scoring like they did in 2019 that can also defend? I think Vanderblas can do that. They got Reese Beckman, Gardner, guys that can spread the floor and finish on the inside because of their athleticism. So I think Virginia is going to be at 18, but their ceiling is going to be really high. They're probably going to finish 3rd in the ACC next year. Auburn at 17, up 4 spots. They're bringing back some guys from last year's team. They're losing their inside presence with Walker Kessler and Jabari Smith, so that's going to hurt them a ton. But I like Auburn at 17. 16 is Michigan, and they are down 8 spots from my last rankings because they took a massive hit today to their roster due to the NBA draft. Caleb Houston and Moasa Diabite both kept their names in the NBA draft, and that really hurts this Michigan team. They got Hunter Dickinson coming back. This Michigan team had a really good shot at, if those two guys came back next year, they had a really good shot at winning the Big Ten and making a run in March, like they almost, like they got to the second weekend this past year. They had a really good shot at doing that if both of those guys came back, with both of them keeping their name in the NBA draft. I don't see that happening. They'll still be ranked almost in the top 15, but I don't see them succeeding as much this year with having a limited roster now with mainly just Hunter Dickinson. At 15, I have TCU up one spot from my last rankings. Tennessee, who I guess I was really sleeping on after seeing some other rankings, I have them at 14. They're bringing back a bunch of guys. None of their like key guards like Kennedy Chandler, nothing crazy like that, but they're bringing back some key players from last year's team that a lot of people were high on. So I have them at 14. Duke, I have Duke down at 13, dropping four spots from my last ranking. You just don't know what to expect with John Shire this year. Trevor Keels announced tonight that he is going to keep his name in the NBA draft. So they're basically losing everybody from last year's team except Jeremy Roach. Don't know what to expect with these freshmen with a new coach like John Shire. You just don't know what to expect from this Duke Blue Devils team. That's why I have them at 13. But it's Duke. They're still going to have that target on their back without Coach K on that sideline, with or without him. So it's going to be a battle for the Blue Devils every single night. John Shire is going to get tested early, especially for how good the recruits are that he has coming in this year. At 12, I have Villanova down two spots from my last rankings, but if they can get healthy with Justin Moore coming back, then I think that their ceiling is pretty high as well. It's Villanova, like same thing as Duke. They got the target on their back, and the I lost my train of thought because of a tweet that just popped up from Goodman that made me laugh. Villanova, they're like the Duke of the Big East. They have the target on their back, the most hated team in the Big East, and they're with a new coach, Jay Wright, stepping down. They're still going to be, I feel like they're going to be right there in the mix, but they got the recruits, Cam Whitmore. They're still going to be pretty good next year. 11, I got Texas, but their ceiling is really high next year. Bringing in Tyrese Hunter from Iowa State, pairing him up with Marcus Carr in the backcourt. You still got Timmy Allen. They are losing Courtney Ramey, though, to the transfer portal. I don't know if the option of coming back is still in the play for him, still in the cards for Courtney Ramey, but pairing Tyrese Hunter, who was probably the biggest name in the transfer portal, with Marcus Carr, like Chris Beard landed two of the biggest names in the transfer portal the past 2 years, and Marcus Carr and Tyrese Hunter. And you also accompany them with Timmy Allen on the wing and on the inside. That's going to be really helpful. I like Texas a lot next year. At number 10, I have Indiana, because the Big Ten goes through Bloomington this year. Trace Jackson Davis is coming back to the Hoosiers. Yes, the Big Ten runs through Bloomington this upcoming season. They are going to be really, really good. This is the most hype that they've had around them since like Cody Zeller and Victor Oladipo, since 2013, really. And Trace Jackson Davis has the potential to be the best player in the country, be the All-American of the Year, AP National Player of the Year. He has that potential. Like, I think somebody's going to have a stellar season in the Big Ten to take Big Ten Player of the Year away from him. So I'm liking Indiana there at 10. At number 9, I got UCLA dropping six spots from my last rankings. I'm starting to not get not super high on them. They got a good recruiting class coming in. They are losing some of their inside bigs, inside presence. They lost Johnny Juzang, but they are bringing back Tiger Campbell and Jaime Hawkes, which is going to be a huge bonus to next year's team, giving them that experience. Jules Bernard is still undecided on what he's doing with the NBA draft or coming back next year. He's got 19 minutes currently, so we will see what happens there. But UCLA at 9. Kansas at 8, but very easily could be rising. I have them going down one, but they could be rising because they got Jalen Wilson back and Kevin McCullough is coming, transferring to Kansas from Texas Tech. And he's withdrawing his name from the NBA draft process and coming back to school to play at Kansas, play in Lawrence. And like this Kansas team, they 100% have the potential of getting back to the Final Four, making a repeat, making another run at it this year. But I don't think they have the quality of wing scoring that they did last year. They don't have the solid inside presence as David McCormick. They don't have anyone near Ochai Agbaji. Grady Dick, he could be a star in the making. MJ Rice could be that spark off the bench for Kansas. But right now, their starting point guard would be DeJuan Harris or DeJuan Harris, and he wasn't really much of a scoring guard. He was more of a create for others, create for Ochai Agbaji, create for Christian Brown, David McCormick. Jalen Wilson's not the go-to scoring option like Ochai Agbaji is. So that's why I have Kansas down that low, and I'm not too incredibly high on them, but it's Kansas, the best atmosphere in college basketball. So, I mean, I don't know. I have Kansas back at 8. I'm trying to find something real quick before I continue. Okay. While I try to find that, I currently have Gonzaga at 7, and that's up 7 spots. But we're going to make some changes here to this, my rankings. I'm going to move Arkansas from 5 to 7 because I'm beginning to not get entirely high on Arkansas. Eric Musselman, love him as a coach, but he's got a great recruiting class coming in, bringing in some key transfers. I think they're still in the play for Amani Bates, but I'm dropping them down to 7. I did have them at 4, dropping them down to 7 now because of the Drew Timmy announcement. At 6, I got Baylor because they're bringing back Adam Flagler, LJ Cryer. They got a good recruiting class, 5-star with Keontae George. They're still going to be pretty deep next year. So I'm liking Baylor at 6. At 5, I got Gonzaga because of the Drew Timmy announcement. They also got Julian Strother coming back. We're going to learn a lot about Nolan Hickman. And, he updated it. Okay. Interesting. John Rothstein has Gonzaga up to 2 now because of Drew Timmy coming back and Julian Strother and Rezar Bolton. I mean, I understand it. I completely understand it, but I'm putting them at 5. At number 4, I have the Kentucky Wildcats, and they are down 2 spots from my last rankings. They easily could be higher, but I have them at 4 because they're returning the best player in college basketball last year, Oscar Tshiebwe. They are also returning Xavier Wheeler. They have a 5-star elite wing forward in Chris Livingston coming next year. They're returning Jacob Toppin. So I am liking, they also got another 5-star Kaysen Wallace. Said CJ Frederick, a shooter off the bench. I'm liking Kentucky at 4 there. At 3, I got Houston because they are returning Marcus Sasser and Kelvin Sampson's an amazing coach. They're bringing back an elite defense, nearly everybody from last year. Jamal Shedd had a great run in March Madness last year for the Cougars last year. And they're bringing back an elite scorer in Marcus Sasser. Like, I really like this Houston team next year. According to FanDuel, Houston is now the favorite to win the national championship. And, I mean, Kelvin Sampson, the defense is insane, dude. I don't know. I just love Houston next year. The Cougars, they're going to be ready to roll, trying to improve themselves for Big 12 play when Houston eventually switches to the Big 12 conference. But I'm liking Houston there at 4. At 2, I have Creighton because they're returning nearly everybody. Ryan Nemhard, they were unhealthy last year. They're bringing back Ryan Nemhard, Ryan Kalkbrenner, and they're also bringing in a really elite transfer in Baylor Sherriman from South Dakota State, a guy that can just really do everything on the floor, can pass, can rebound, can score. Was just everybody was so high on him in South Dakota State, the Jackrabbits coming into the NCAA tournament. I picked them to move on, and he was a highly rated transfer in this year's transfer portal, and he ended up landing at Creighton. Creighton will be the best team in the Big East next year, without a doubt. And they, I don't think they'll be at 2 once the ratings do come out in late October, November time, because it's Creighton. They're going to put Gonzaga or Kentucky at 2, maybe even Houston. But I'm liking Creighton at 2 for my rankings. And then number 1, the North Carolina Tar Heels. That's even bringing back everybody. They're going to be really tough to beat with the experience that they have, the dominant inside presence that they have in Armando Bacot. They still have one roster spot open, so it's interesting to see who they're trying to get right now. I think they're still in the play for Pete Nance from Northwestern, the skilled big that can fill Brady Manick's role. So be on the lookout for that to see if North Carolina fills that last roster spot. So that is my second and updated way too early top 25. So now we're going to close out the show here today with NBA Finals preview. The Warriors and Celtics. This is a very interesting matchup. I think the Celtics, they match up so much better because of their length, their size. I mean, yeah, Robert Williams, Father Time on the inside, great defender. You also got Al Horford, both two guys on the inside that are really long. Robert Williams is really athletic, can block shots, great defender. And then you got Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown on the wings that can also step out and guard shooters. And Marcus Smart, the Defensive Player of the Year. SportsCenter posted today, the Celtics have a strong chance to beat the Warriors in the NBA Finals, according to ESPN's BPI. According to BPI, the Celtics have an 86% chance to win against the Warriors, just making the Warriors even more of an underdog, which they want. So that's just another chip, add another chip to the shoulder to this Warriors team. The keys for the Celtics, I'm thinking the Celtics are an underdog because of how the Warriors have been playing. And, I mean, the experience between the teams. Like, the Warriors, they have 123 games played in the NBA Finals. The Celtics roster, out of all the players combined, don't have one game in the NBA Finals played. Don't have one game, and the Warriors have each combined for 123 games. That is insane. The experience is, like, that's kind of what makes me want to go, like, Warriors in 5 or something. Something crazy like that. But if I'm the Celtics, I mean, these are both top two teams in scoring and top two teams in defense. That's the first time that's ever happened. I mean, that's how it's supposed to be, the top two in offense and defense right there playing for the NBA Finals, playing for the championship. And it's just going to be, I love the matchups. I think the matchups favor the Celtics because of who the Warriors have and the lineups that the Warriors throw out there, because of the Celtics' length and size that it can eventually catch up to the Warriors' quickness when the Warriors go small. So if I'm the Celtics, we've seen it a few times in this playoffs with the Warriors when they get sloppy with the ball, turn it over. And we saw it in Game 5 against Memphis. I mean, they weren't, you could kind of tell they weren't exactly trying too hard, but they still got blown out. They still got blown out of the gym. Turned the ball over a ton. They had some sloppy turnovers in Game 6 against Memphis as well. They had a great series against Dallas. So it just depends on how they're riding. But if I'm Boston, I'm playing to how I'm trying to play how we've played all postseason long. The defense with Brooklyn, the defense with Milwaukee, the defense with the Heat, and we're gonna learn right away from the beginning of the series how the officials, it's gonna be on the officials really, because if I'm the Celtics, I'm playing physical on the defensive end with this Golden State Warriors team, getting real physical, pushing them around, being tough with them, because you get physical with Steph or Jordan Poole or Klay, like, they're not going to be making their shots all the time because they're getting beat up. If they're physical with them, bumping them on cuts, chesting them up when on drives, and not really letting them do much, it's going to throw them off 100%. So we're going to get we're going to know how this series is going to go based off the officiating in Game 1, how the officials are going to let Boston be defensively, because that should be the number one thing for Boston, is be physical with this Golden State Warriors team. They just love to shoot the ball. They love to spread the floor, run around, get open shots, share the ball. If they turn it into ISO ball and force turnovers because they're being physical, then the Celtics got this series in six or seven, easy. But that's where the Warriors' experience comes into play. If I'm also the Celtics on the offensive end, I'm trying to get a ball screen action with Jason Tatum or Jaylen Brown with Stephen Curry. Yeah, Steph's defense has been the best it's been in his career. He's been playing great defense. But like in the games that I saw against the Mavs, he kind of looked like he didn't want that matchup with Luka. I love Steph and I'm saying that about him, but it kind of looked like he didn't want that matchup with Luka. Like he's hedging hard and then trying to get the primary defender back on to Luka. And what hurt Dallas in Game 5 was, like, Steph would try and hedge, and Luka would either drive, and then the drive gets taken away. Luka then kicks it out to a shooter, extra pass for another shooter, shots aren't getting knocked down. With this Celtics team, the shots are going to get knocked down on those extra passes, because Tatum or Jaylen Brown is going to come off a ball screen with Steph as the help defender, hedging hard, trying to get Draymond, Wiggins, or Klay back onto him, or onto them, and they're going to hit the roll, pick and pop for Al Horford or something like that. Or they're going to throw a skip pass over to Marcus Smart, and then Marcus Smart's going to throw that extra pass to like a Peyton Pritchard or a Grant Williams or somebody like that that's going to knock down a wide open shot in the corner. That's how the Celtics got here, was making open shots. They got the guy. They have the type of guys that can spread the floor. And I think that's how Boston has to win this series, is if they have to attack Steph Curry on the offensive end of the floor, force him to guard on the pick and roll, and then you just got to knock down shots. You got to trust your teammates that they can knock down shots on offense, knock down those open shots. If Boston can do that, they'll win the NBA. They'll be hosting the NBA trophy at the end of the season, at the end of this series. For Golden State, I mean, they're just playing tremendous basketball. They got to just continue to share the wealth, continue to share it around, spread the floor with this team, with these guys. Let Steph be Steph. I think that because Al Horford has been playing out of his mind on this playoffs run, especially on the defensive end of the floor. You also got Robert Williams, who was an all-defensive player, could have been in the conversation for Defensive Player of the Year if he was healthy. So, I mean, you don't want to just run ball screens. If you run ball screens, then you have to hit the roll with Draymond. hit the roll with Draymond, caused some help, and then shooters Jordan Poole, Wiggins, Jordan Poole, Clay, spotting up on the outside. They got to be ready to knock down some shots. I don't think that. I don't think that running that high ball screen with Draymond is the way to go in this series because of how the length of the Celtics has been. Because they get in passing lanes, they get deflections. They're going to have to just continue. They might have to let Draymond run the point and then just have Jordan Poole, Steph, and Klay just be running around. Kevon Looney setting the screens, Andrew Wiggins setting the screens for those guys to come off and knock down shots, because that's how they're going to get their open looks. Like, in their offense is coming off of stagger screens, off the ball screens, and Draymond just finds them on a step in three, something like that. Back cuts, because Marcus Smart's going to overplay Steph like there's no end, like there's no tomorrow. He's going to overplay Steph, not let him get any shots. And the way that Steph can move without the ball, he can get those backdoor layups. It's just, it's as easy as going up and setting a flare screen for Clay. Attention goes to Clay, but then Steph slips it. Wide open bounce pass for Steph, easy layup. So the Warriors, that's how they become deadly, is because of the way they know how to move without the basketball. The way Jordan Poole can create for himself, the way Steph can get himself open without the basketball, the way Klay Thompson can get himself open without the basketball, because they've put in the work, they've put in that practice, those many reps of setting your man up to get hit by the screen, come off the screen so that you're open, or it causes the screener to get open. That's how the Warriors are going to get their looks. So if the Warriors are going to want to win this series, yeah, they're going to have to be tremendous on the defensive end. They're going to have to figure out ways to contain Jason Tatum, contain Jaylen Brown, make others beat you like Marcus Smart. If Marcus Smart is knocking down shots, then you go and shake their hand. But if he's not, then the Warriors got it on the defensive end of the floor. On offense, they have to spread the floor. I think they have to let Draymond go at the one and just run around and come off screens for the shooters, Steph and Clay, Jordan Poole, Wiggins spotting up in the corner, setting the screen and then pop in case they hedge hard on a Steph curl or a Clay curl, something like that. They're going to get open looks because of the attention the shooters get. They're going to get overplayed, back cuts happen, or slip screens happen. So if the Warriors are going to win, that's how they have to do it on the offensive end, is setting away screens and coming up and knocking down those shots. To close out the show here, I'm going to say Warriors in six. Here's how it's going to go. The Warriors, coming off of their long rest, go on and the experience wins game one. The nerves are going to get to the Celtics, being their first finals appearance in for most of these guys, and it's their franchise's first finals in 12 years. I think the Warriors get game one. Celtics make it. No, here's how it's going to go. I'm trying to think if I want to do this. Yeah, Celtics take game two at Golden State to get all the conversations back. Oh man, can the Celtics do this? Can they pull off this big upset here, heading back to Boston with all the momentum? Game three, game four, and Warriors take game three, and then Celtics take game four to tie it up, heading back to the Bay. Warriors take the next two. We get a magical performance from Steph in game five and game six. Warriors win in six in the famous TD Garden for the 75th season of the NBA, and Steph Curry has named his first finals MVP, and there's going to be a lot of talk about his legacy and where he ranks among the NBA players, current and past, where he ranks on the Mount Rushmore. Yes, I'm saying that. So, I'm taking Warriors in six. Booking it right there. They got the experience. They got the momentum. They've got the shot creators, the lethal weapons from the outside that spread the floor. They're deep. They're getting healthy. I like the Warriors in six. That's all I got for you guys today. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. NBA Finals tips off, since I'm airing this now today on June 2nd. The NBA Finals begins today. 9 o'clock tip on ABC in San Francisco. Celtics, Warriors. Let's go, baby. Closing in on the conclusion of the 75th NBA season with an amazing NBA Finals here. So let's go. Warriors, Celtics, 9 o'clock tip tonight. Don't want to miss it. Thank you guys again for tuning in. This was Beyond the Arc, episode 57. Getting up there, man. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. We will see you next time.